This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome. We're excited this morning to have with us Dr. Craig Keener. He's an academic here in North America. He teaches, is a professor of New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary, and he's written a seminal work on miracles. I mean, this is a big thing, two thick books I've been working my way through, and you're not going to believe some of the stuff he's got to share today. The question you should ask yourself before I introduce our speaker further is, are the miracles described in the New Testament trustworthy accounts of God's activity in the world, or are they mere relics of superstition left in the pages of the Bible as shadows of religion built on empty hopes? Dr. Keener has some thoughts, to be sure, and our challenge is to give you the best in our very short time we have here of 1 hour. So, listener, hold on, and truly, I hope you enjoy this, because Dr. Keener, I've so enjoyed reading what you have to write. Thank you for being with us this morning.
It's my privilege.
And you've written, I guess, now some 17 books. I noticed that four of them won book awards with Christianity Today, and your IVP Bible Background Commentary has sold more than 500,000 copies in how many languages?
Oh, I haven't kept track of the number. I know that it's sold like 50,000 copies or 60,000 copies in Korean, and it's in a number of other languages. It's in Chinese and Spanish and Portuguese, and the French is about to come out, Russian, German, I think Armenian, and there are probably some others. I hope I'm not leaving anyone out.
Well, I'm not surprised, you know, looking at the gift you have for writing and bringing up detail that God is using what you've written. But it's curious to me how you came to be interested in this whole thing of miracles. That doesn't seem like the normal thing that a New Testament professor gets into.
Well, my interest in miracles, I guess, probably goes back to having experienced some. But my interest in the study of miracles in an academic way really comes because I was writing a commentary on Acts, and I was dealing with the historical questions. And one of the objections that people raise, they say, well, you know, Acts, we might otherwise accept it as historical, but look, it has all these miracle stories, and eyewitnesses would never claim miracle stories. And my immediate response was, that's not true. I know lots of eyewitnesses who do claim that they have seen miracles. And so I was just going to go and get a few sources, but the footnote grew and grew. I got more and more interested, more and more excited, and it grew to about 1,200 pages.
More than a footnote. You've got a lot of references there, too, and documented sources. It's kind of overwhelming in some measure. But I want the listener to hear, if you don't mind, how many sources you cited. And the reason is, listener, I want you to understand this, as we get into a topic that you think is all maybe, this is a tendency, isn't it? Miracles. Well, it's emotional. It's just based on people's stories. There's no verification. No, we're talking now to a scholar about this very important topic. How many sources did you cite in your book?
I cited about 4,000 different works, not including the ancient sources.
Wow. Now, here's a leading question. Why do scholars today, not all of them, but many of them, assume that miracles do not occur? Just not going to happen, probably never did.
Yeah, I like your word, assume, because in most cases, it's just a circular argument. It's simply people assuming that it doesn't happen. It's not just a matter of information. It's a matter of the framework that we use to interpret the information. So when people assume that miracles can't happen, then when they get evidence for miracles, they explain it away as something else. I have medical documentation from one person whose eye was, she had an eye condition, was instantly healed during prayer, and she went back to the eye doctor, and of course the doctor could certify that she had the condition before and didn't have it now, but the doctor said, well, that's not a miracle, and the person said, well, have you ever seen this happen before? And not only had the person never seen it happen before, the eye doctor had never, ever seen it happen. but concluded that it wasn't a miracle because miracles don't happen. So presuppositions play a major role in how people interpret it. And that shouldn't surprise us. I mean, when Jesus raised Lazarus, it says many who were there believed in him, and then many of the others went on their way and reported to the Pharisees, this guy's causing trouble.
Mm-hmm. I've met many times people who say the same kind of thing, just show me a miracle, and I'm thinking, in fact, I say back usually, I could show you a miracle, not that I can do it, but if God did so, I don't know that it would change your viewpoint any, because you're not searching for God, and how far will it take you, really? Now, let's go back to a skeptic earlier times, because you base your book in some measure on Hume, and tell us who Hume is and what kind of argument he made about miracles.
David Hume was an 18th century philosopher, and he wrote an essay on miracles that actually was not very prominent in Hume's own day. There were other essays that were more prominent. In fact, today when scholars read Hume's argument, they often say, you know, some of this doesn't make sense. We can't figure out how it fits together. But it's because Hume was taking for granted some widely spread deist arguments in his own day that he was simply developing in his own essay. It wasn't that influential in his day, but because of Hume's stature as a philosopher, that essay became widely circulated. But it's often regarded by philosophers, I mean, philosophers debate it still today, and many of them regard it as one of the more logically problematic of his essays.
Okay. So basically, he's arguing, because I've not experienced a miracle, I don't think they happen. There's no verification. And your book has more than 1,000 pages saying, you know what, it really is happening. It has happened. What do you see as problematic, going back to Hume, about his essay? What are the weak points there in his argument?
Well, he has a couple arguments. And again, there's some debate about exactly what he meant and certain parts of it. But first, he argues that natural law says that miracles can't happen. They would be violations of natural law, and therefore they can't happen, which is kind of a circular argument. And it's also based on a view of natural law that doesn't comport with what philosophers of science today mean by natural law. And also he was trying to use the mechanistic worldview of Isaac Newton and others. But Isaac Newton and the early Newtonians believed in miracles. They did not see that as a contradiction. They said, you know, if you have laws in nature, the one who made the laws has every right to go around them whenever he wants to. But Hume didn't think so, and that's influenced modern skeptical views. But Hume's other argument is, it's kind of related to this, the idea of laws. He says, uniform human experience proves that miracles don't happen. We know from everybody's experience miracles don't happen. Well, what happens if you have an eyewitness who says they do happen? He says, well, you can't trust those eyewitnesses because it's a violation of uniform human experience. Now, if that's not a circular argument, I don't know what would qualify as one.
Honestly, yeah, how could he assume that his experience was a basis for ruling out other people's claims of experience? We're talking experience to experience here.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and at this point, I don't think he was consistent with his own epistemology, his own view of how to find knowledge. I'll leave that to other people to discuss. But one example that was bantered back and forth between Hume and his early critics, they talked about somebody in a faraway country who had never seen ice in a very warm part of the world. And so some visitors told the person about rivers that were frozen in winter. And the person refused to believe it because it was against his experience. Well, Hume says the person is right to disbelieve it because it's against their experience. Mm. And his critics said, no, actually, you're missing the point. You are like that person who refuses to believe credible testimony from others. Hume's problem is that he accepted only a very narrow kind of experience. He says the witnesses have to be they can't be from the non-Western world. He didn't accept non-Western testimony. He said they can't be from earlier times. We don't accept that. and he also said they have to be from witnesses who are highly respectable and have no reason to lie and so on. And, you know, there were such witnesses. So what did Hume do with them? He said, well, they actually aren't credible because they claim miracles.
Wow. To the listener, we're talking with Dr. Craig Keener, and he's written 1,200 pages on a two-volume series called Miracles. But we're thinking about, eventually, as we get into this, miracles around the world. And I want you to really stay tuned. We're trying to give you some background first about the whole concept, the argument against miracles. And a classic case has been David Hume. Now, Craig, you mentioned Hume having experiences that didn't fit his grid. In other words, not just back in time. There were people in his time that he's arguing with. What do you have in mind there? Do you have some examples?
Well, there was one that was in fairly recent history. It was the healing of the niece of Blaise Pascal. And, of course, Blaise Pascal is the famous mathematician, kind of the father of modern computers, a brilliant mathematician and theologian. He became a theologian briefly before he passed away. But Pascal was convinced by this healing. It was his niece. She had an organic running sore on her eye. And it was healed instantly and publicly. And there were many witnesses. The Queen of France sent her own physician to examine the healing and was convinced. And yet Hume dismisses it because he says simply, miracles don't happen. And look, this one was well documented. So why would you believe ones in the New Testament that aren't really as well documented medically as this one was? But he simply dismisses it, and he got away with it because the healing was in Jansenist circles that were too Catholic for the Protestants and too Protestant for the Catholics. And back then, because of the different groups fighting each other, he said, well, look, you all dismiss this. Why would you believe anything else?
Wow. Now, you know, what I want to do is move us to the present day, but let's go back for a minute, if you don't mind. Are there examples earlier in history that someone could point Hume to or us to about the miracle-working hand of God?
For certain. many of the church fathers were citing miracles as evidences of what God was doing, the Christian faith, Irenaeus, Origen, Tertullian, all these church fathers were, many of them were naming instances that they had seen themselves. They also were naming prominent people who had been healed when Christians prayed for them. Quadratus, who was a very early writer, talked about people that Jesus raised from the dead. He said, you know, he was writing very early, he said, some of them are still alive to this day. Mm. And Augustine, is writing a few centuries later, he believed that miracles had mostly ceased, but then he had eyewitness experience of miracles and changed his view. He had a friend with an anal abscess, and the man was just crying out to God, pleading for God to heal him, because I mean, sometimes people bled to death during surgery back then. I mean, thank God for surgeons today, but I mean, back then sometimes they bled to death. They had no anesthesia. It's a very painful part of the body to begin with. And so he was crying out to God, and Augustine was with him. The next morning they went in for the surgery, and they opened, took off the bandage to look at the wound, and it was gone. And Augustine himself was healed, and he reports that his church, in just 2 years after they started collecting affidavits, of eyewitness testimonies of healings, usually multiply attested by independent witnesses. They had 70 accounts, including raisings from the dead. You have a lot of this going on through history. During the Reformation, there was a reaction against some of the claims during the Middle Ages because a lot of people believed that they were healed through relics, which, you know, like the bones of saints, and some of the, well, a lot of them weren't actually from real saints, you know, they were just bones. But, you know, God, I think, touches people. Those could have been contact points of faith. But in any case, you know, Wesley's day, Wesley certainly argued against Hume's approach, and there are reports of healings taking place during that revival. In fact, on Christmas in 1742, Wesley prayed for somebody, a Mr. Myrick, who was believed to be dead, and the person revived. And this is recorded in Wesley's own journal for that day. So it's not like this is, you know, some later thing. And then, you know, in the late 19th century, there was even a greater revival of interest in healing. There was an interdenominational movement. A.J. Gordon, who was a Baptist, A.B. Simpson, the founder of Christian Missionary Alliance, Boardman, who was Presbyterian, D.B. Palmer, who was Methodist, and just a lot of other people. There was an interdenominational emphasis on healing that was very prominent among evangelicals.
It's interesting. One last thought about Hume. Because he really represents the skeptic around us and in all of us. And it's easy to read the Bible and say, well, that was way back then. You know, and if you confirm its real history, well, it was another culture. And you mentioned Hume's dismissing views of other cultures. Was he against these cultures? I mean, give us a little perspective.
Yeah. Now, what I'm saying here is not meant to denigrate everybody who doesn't believe in miracles as if this is, you know, but a lot of them just assume Hume's position without knowing Hume's reasons for his position. When he rejects all testimonies from other cultures, Hume said that there was no civilized nation of any other complexion than white, and he says that there are other kinds of or other species of people, and they are inferior to the whites. He said none of the slaves ever achieved learning. And he admits that there's one Jamaican who was known to recite poetry, he says, but he says any parrot can do that. Now, my wife from Africa, she has a PhD, and so this stuff really annoys me, but the Jamaican that he dismisses that way actually was Francis Williams, who was a Cambridge graduate. He composed poetry in English and in Latin.
Wow.
Hume argued in favor of slavery. He was still being cited a century later by pro-slavery people in support of their position. So all that needs to be taken into account when you hear Hume saying, okay, we can't accept testimony outside of our culture.
Okay, what about other cultures today? You know, our world is becoming smaller, even as it's larger by the numbers of people with the Internet and mass media. We're all one in some sense. But what's going on? Are miracles happening today? What are other cultures? What's their view on this whole thing?
That's a really important question because, I mean, the Christians in the majority world are now the majority of Christians. Mm-hmm. Africa, Asia, Latin America, in 1900 it was maybe 18% of Christians. It's over 60% of them today. And it's estimated that by 2025 it'll be around 70%. Some people have said miracles are impossible. Justo Gonzalez says they happen all the time in Latino churches. It's especially happening in cutting edge evangelism in new areas. The Korean revival at the beginning of the 20th century, healings were a major part of that. J.P. Moreland mentions that up to 70% of evangelical growth around the world in recent decades is intimately connected with signs and wonders, and I found plenty of reports of it before then. In China, there's reports from within China, from within the China Christian Council, someone reported that it was said that half of the new conversions of the previous 20 years were due to faith healing experiences. Another source within the house church movement estimated in rural areas it's up to 90%. Whatever the figures are, it's just extraordinary. And if I can go on to talk about...
Yeah, do keep going. This gets to the heart of it, Craig. I've titled this program Miracles Around the World, so you're really hitting on this now. I mean, reading your book, it just really impressed me. I walked away with a clear sense. As you stated it, and gave so much backup that we're in an isolated bubble in a materialistic society, and we think these things, maybe they never happen, maybe they don't happen. And Christians around the world, as you said, the vast majority are saying, no, this is normative. This is what normally happens. What's going on with those people in the West, you know?
They read the Bible for themselves without reading it through the grid of, you know, Humean philosophy that has pervaded our Western way of looking at things. But and also, where people don't have the resources we have, I mean, thank God for the resources we have, but where people don't have those, sometimes they all they can do is cry to God desperately for God to intervene. And God, I mean, it's not like miracles happen every time we pray, but God answers the prayers. Our Pentecostal and charismatic brothers and sisters, defined broadly today, it's about, well, the estimates vary, but it's about 500 million people, which is a higher number than mainline Protestants. And some sociologists have argued that they account for maybe 80% of evangelicalism's worldwide growth. There was a Pew Forum survey of just 10 countries undertaken in 2006. It didn't include China, which I mentioned above. But you look at the figures, the percentages, and so on, roughly 200 million Pentecostals and Charismatics in these countries, this is just a rough estimate, but claim to have experienced or witnessed miraculous healing. So that's just 10 countries.
Wow.
And what may be more shocking, though, to many people is that in the same survey, 39% of Christians who are not or don't consider themselves Pentecostal or Charismatic in these countries claim to have experienced or witnessed divine healing. You've got Reformed Christians in Indonesia who claim to have witnessed people being raised from the dead or blind eyes being instantly healed. You've got Presbyterians in Malawi, Baptists in Tanzania or Chile. You've got Mennonites in Ethiopia. Just around the world, God is doing amazing things in His church. And it's not to say that every claim that somebody thinks is a miracle, that all of us would necessarily agree that every one of those is a miracle. But Hume simply can't start from the premise that uniform human experience excludes miracles. You can't speak of uniform human experience when you've got hundreds of millions of supposed exceptions or possible exceptions.
Okay, well, this begs the question that some listeners are probably just waiting to be asked. Are any of these miracles medically documented?
The short answer is yes, but before I go to that, most areas where people pray for supernatural healing to a great extent, it's because they don't have medical help available. That was true where my wife grew up. And, you know, medical help would really would save a whole lot more lives in those places, but many of them don't have medical help, so they have no way to medically document the things that take place. But then again, there's some things where you don't need a doctor to be the witness. I mean, if you see a tumor disappear in front of you, it doesn't make a difference whether it's a doctor witnessing it or somebody else. I mean, we all have eyes. I have friends who have seen people with blind eyes instantly healed. A friend who is director, was at least the last time I spoke with him, of Cambridge Business Institute. He was in India. He prayed for somebody, and I also talked with another witness who was there. The person's eyes were clouded. Presumably, that means they had cataracts, which can only be removed surgically by natural means. And the person was instantly healed of blindness. Now, God can heal psychosomatic things, of course, too, but cataracts aren't psychosomatic. But we do have some documentation. Dr. Rex Gardner wrote a book and a medical journal article, and some other people were able to get me medical documentation, including a doctor who was reporting people being healed. And I'm hearing more from other doctors now. But, of course, once the book comes out, more people know that I was looking for the information. But you don't find as much of it in medical journals. And people say, well, why not in medical journals? The thing is, medical journals and scientific journals in general deal with what's replicable, what you can experiment on. Miracles, by definition, are not replicable. But then again, neither are a lot of areas of knowledge. I mean, journalism, if you have to be able to experiment and repeat the experience before you can count it, we're done with journalism, we're done with history. And so, dealing with the acts of a person, whether it's a human person or a divine person, we're not dealing with something where we can predict this is going to happen again necessarily under these circumstances. But coming back to medical documentation, yes, there is medical documentation.
I have us hold right now just for a very short break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I want you to take this whole thing of documentation and move it towards something. Listeners, you're going to have to hold on for this break, because when we come back, Dr. Keener is going to move us into the question also about the raising of the dead. We'll be right back.
Have you ever wanted to read the entire Bible from cover to cover? Most Christians have, and you may even be among those who have attempted it. Yet only 10% of Christians have ever read the entire Bible. B90, or Bible in 90 Days, is a Bible reading program that can help you achieve this important goal for your life and for your spiritual development. By reading only 12 pages a day, you and your friends, your Bible study group, or even your entire church can read the Bible in 90 days. To find out more about B90, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com and click on B90, Bible in 90 Days. Read every word that God has spoken and shared with humanity. Check it out. That's B90 at scriptureawakening.com.
Welcome back. This is Bill Campbell. We have with us Dr. Craig Keener. He's a New Testament professor, and he's written, among his other writings, a volume really in two pieces about miracles. And we're coming now into the thick of it. And this is really fascinating. He's talked some about the history of skepticism and historically evidence for miracles through time. And I brought up the question about miracles in other cultures, and he's taken us to other parts of the world, and we're kind of finishing with that, and we're heading toward, you don't have to jump right into this, Craig, but we're heading toward the question about even the raising from the dead of people who have been expired, so to speak. But go ahead, pick up where we left off.
Well, there are even some places in the majority world where it's hard to get medical documentation, but there was a medical team that went to Mozambique, where there have been many reports of raisings from the dead and healings of blindness and deafness and so on. And the medical team investigated people's blindness and deafness before prayer versus after prayer, and they actually found differences. And this one was published in a medical journal. Now, obviously, that's the kind of thing that's going to generate controversy, and it has. The controversy also was recently answered by Candy Gunther Brown, a professor at Indiana University, and her Harvard University Press book, Testing Prayer. She defended the studies, as you know, preliminary studies as they are. But I interviewed a cardiologist from Florida about a raising from the dead that he experienced. He was present when the person had been dead for like 40 minutes, according to all the American Heart Association protocols. You're not supposed to revive after 40 minutes, especially with no brain damage, when you're certified as being completely dead. But anyway, in terms of other raisings from the dead, I understand some people may freak out about such reports, and I approached them with caution myself, but after a while I had to think about, why? Why do I have this intrinsic skepticism towards this? Is it because I am approaching this as an academic with the Humean bias that's part of the baggage of my culture? And eventually I had to give it up, because many of the people, about 10 of the people who gave me accounts, were people that I knew personally. Who had witnessed people being raised from the dead. I have family in Africa and elsewhere where it's just it happens more often. But in any case, some people say, well, certain kinds of healings can be psychosomatic, but that's pretty hard to say in the case of somebody being raised from the dead. So it is true, you know, most of these places, there's not medical documentation, and there's no medical apparatus to ascertain how dead the person is, in contrast to the one I just mentioned about the cardiologist. In many of these places, they don't have, well, maybe the reason the person died to begin with was because they didn't have medical apparatus. But people can tell when somebody's not breathing. People can tell when somebody's not been breathing for hours. And many of these cases are cases like that. I have, just in my random interviews with people, I came across eyewitness experiences, one from the Philippines, actually a couple from the Philippines, but one from the person who was dead for a while. Somebody who was dead for 24 hours in Sri Lanka, or at least believed to be dead by the doctors in that hospital. in Nigeria, a couple friends of mine, people that I know very well and trust, one of them, a fellow New Testament scholar from Nigeria, talked about people being raised from the dead after a significant amount of time.
Can I want to say something, Craig.
Yeah.
You know, someone listening may say, well, yeah, maybe it was a comatose thing, and they're recording those rare occasions where someone seemed to be dead and they really weren't. But no, tell me if this is true. I suspect, based on my own experience and having traveled quite a bit, we're talking about places. It could be a tribe. It could be a city where someone could tell you, or a whole group of people, a family, a whole tribe of people, whatever, all of our lives through the generations, we've never seen anything like this. People die, they're dead. In this
right.
case, someone came and with great faith and authority in the name of Jesus prayed and for them to be raised from the dead, and they were. It was
yeah.
tied to prayer. It
yeah.
was a powerful move of God that broke through the norm. That's why we call it a miracle. Is that right?
It did break through the norm, and that's why in some places, like we talked about the new conversions in China, I mean, this was different enough from people's normal experience that they actually changed centuries of belief based on it. It wasn't just like the kind of thing that happens once in a while where you know, you got it wrong. And also, there's an accumulation of these things around prayer. So that, I mean, if at one point I figured out just randomly, if we say there's like one chance in 100,000 of this, something like this, we thought the person was dead, they're not dead, they just come back.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to multiply those odds every time it happens in the same circle. If I know personally 10 cases in my immediate circle of people, I mean, we're talking, the odds are less than 1 in, you know, 10 billion. I mean, it's more than the world's population. I shouldn't have so many in my own circle, and just I happen to be the one writing this book.
I'm just a regular guy and a pastor, and I've seen a lot of miracles. I know people who have a gift of faith and prayer, and they see this consistently. And this is why I want the listeners to understand, this is not hocus pocus we're talking about. These are places where people are coming in faith, and they're seeing miracles. They're seeing something totally different than the natural law would cause us to expect.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, somebody in my brother's church experienced this. My brother's trained with a PhD in physics. But in Congo Brazzaville, where my wife is from, she just took me around to talk with people who were people from her Evangelical Church of Congo. It's the largest Protestant denomination in Congo. And it's not even a Pentecostal denomination, but in just 3 weeks of talking to people, I had 7 eyewitness accounts of people being raised from the dead from people that were closely known to my wife and her family. And one of these was particularly interesting, and that was this woman was telling me about how her daughter, when she was 2 years old, her daughter was bitten by a snake, cried out that she'd been bitten by a snake. By the time the mother got to her, the daughter wasn't breathing. And she strapped the child to her back There was no medical help available in the village. She ran to a nearby village, and there was a family friend, Coco Moise, who was doing evangelism there. He prayed for the baby, and the baby started breathing again, and then the next day she was fine. She has no brain damage. She recently completed seminary in a neighboring country, a master's degree. And so I asked, how far was it between these two villages? And she had to stop and think, and, remembering, okay, up this hill, down the hill. She said about 3 hours.
Wow.
That the child wasn't breathing. Well, I had reports where it was like 8 hours or longer than that. But what was striking about this particular report was that I'd heard this story before. I just hadn't gotten all the details, because the woman that I was interviewing was my mother-in-law, and the person who was raised is my sister-in-law, Therese.
Wow. That'll inspire a scholar to think twice.
Yeah, that was really the tipping point for me, I think. But there are published accounts, too. I mean, some sociologists interviewed people in India, eyewitnesses, Hindu eyewitnesses of people being raised from the dead through Christian prayer, and so on. So, I mean, there's a lot of evidence out there. People just, you know, keep explaining it all away and explaining it all away, but that's their choice. That's not because God hasn't given evidence.
Greg, I think that if the average American, or Westerner, I should say, because Europe is full of unbelief, it's got a very old faith there that needs some dusting off and waking up. But if the average dead Christian would get out and travel the world or talk to missionaries who've lived in many of these other countries, the two-thirds world, they would have their eyes open because these things are so normative. I remember one website. In fact, this blogger actually has come some against you in your book. He says, what about the amputees? You've got people who have maybe no arms or no legs. If there's a real God, why doesn't he just grow those things right back to the people who pray? Have you ever seen anything like that happen? A limb come back in your research, but also I'd like to tackle that one with you just for a minute, because I think there are some good answers to that. Take it sure. away. Why don't you start us?
Sure. In terms of limbs growing back, I have not. Well, okay. You asked if I've seen it. I have not seen it myself, mm-hmm. but there are other things that are of a comparable nature to that, where you have lumps instantly disappearing in plain sight. You have wounds, large wounds closing. One of these was given to me by a doctor. He reached his hand into the wound and prayed for it. The person was going to have his leg amputated because the thing had just grown so large and was continuing to spread. And it wasn't instant, but within a week, the wound completely closed. I asked the doctor, can that happen on its own? Not being a doctor myself, he answered me incredulously, no, that can't happen. Yeah. What's wrong with you? I mean, he didn't say what's wrong with you, but it sounded like that's what he was implying. And a number of other cases where, cataracts disappearing, all of these are organic, clearly organic things, and instantly disappearing, or organic things. It's not possible to explain those in other ways.
Yeah. Wow. To me, the thing about the limbs...
And there are reports of limbs growing back also, but I haven't been able to chase those down in terms of being able to talk with the eyewitnesses in those cases.
Yeah. I think part of it goes to this. You mentioned reports, so many more miracles where there's a desperate need because there's no hospital system anyway, like Heidi and Roland Baker is a great example. They're in Mozambique, and she comes to the States and says, the only way I can see miracles is when I go to the terminally ill, the ones that are so desperate they're going to die anyway, so they're willing to come to me in faith because the hospital can't help them, you know, when she comes to America. And in the same way, I think someone loses a limb, but it's not their life, it's not life-threatening, and they start adjusting, and it's harder for them to come to this place of desperation. I think it has a lot to do with the person's situation. That's just my opinion. Does God love everybody? Absolutely. I don't think it's a matter of God's lack of power, but there's a lot with miracles that ties to the heart of God. Do you mind segueing from our conversation? What do miracles say to you about the heart of God?
when we look at Jesus' ministry, now, not all miracles are like this. I mean, you have the 10 plagues in Egypt and so on, but when you look at Jesus' ministry, the vast majority of his miracles involved healing, deliverance, and then occasionally nature miracles where he was protecting people from storms and so on. They show God's compassion. They show his heart towards us. And you see that even in the people that Jesus reached out to. I mean, he wasn't going around hobnobbing with the elite, trying to build a political support base. I mean, I guess that's what politicians have to do, but that's not what Jesus' ministry was. Jesus reached out to the morally marginalized. He reached out to the economically marginalized. He reached out to the sick and the infirm who were, you know, not at the center of people's attention, not at the center of those who were the movers and shakers of society. And that tells us something about what his kingdom is about. It's not based on human power. It's based on God's power and God's love. It's the same love that drove Jesus to the cross, and the same faith in God's power that drove our Lord to the cross, trusting in the power of the Father to raise him up.
You mentioned nature miracles. That's an interesting topic. I think of Jesus walking on the water and then stilling the storm. And I was in Korea and heard a couple accounts of people walking on water, not to show off, but because God was at work. It was tied to bringing help, bringing the gospel to others. But what about this whole area of nature miracles? Have you heard any stories there?
Yeah, I've heard a number of stories about nature miracles. I've not heard as many about walking on water. I've heard some of those. I wasn't able to interview the witnesses in that case, but many other kinds of nature miracles. There's one that comes to my mind right away, and this is from Emmanuel Atopson, who was my colleague, professor at the seminary where I used to teach. Emmanuel is from Nigeria, and when he grew up, his father was evangelizing in non-Christian areas. And his father had just moved into a village. He was trying to get a roof on this house that they had just put up. But rainy season was coming. Everybody knew rainy season was coming. And people were mocking him. They were saying, "Ha, you know, the rain is coming now, and you're going to get wet, and everything you have is going to be ruined." And Emmanuel's father, in anger, he just called out, "No, there's not going to be one drop of rain in this village until I get the roof on my house or on my hut." And people laughed and then walked away. And he said, "Oh, God, what have I done? I've put your honor at stake." And he fell on his face. He said, "Please, God, don't let it rain until we get this roof on," which was going to take 3 or 4 more days. For the next 3 or 4 more days, it rained all around the village, but not a drop of rain fell in the village itself. And at the end of those 3 or 4 days, there was only one person in that village who had not become a Christian.
Wow. Ooh, I love it. Which chills down my spine, to be quite honest. But here is, Craig, the kind of thing someone, if there's any skeptic listening right now, may say that, you know, if God can do that kind of thing, raise the dead, heal the sick, move things around in nature, but we have all these calamities in nature, why is he not doing good stuff and miraculous things all the time? It should be 24/7 if he's a loving God. What do you say to that?
A miracle is by definition exceptional. It's different from God's normal working in the world. I mean, God benevolently created the world. He benevolently set the world up to work in ways that humanity can exist. I mean, we have so much to be grateful in nature. I think it was one agnostic scientist said the most miraculous thing he could think of was DNA. Well, you know, that's pretty extraordinary. It's true. But at the same time, God doesn't do miracles all the time. It often happens on the cutting edge of evangelism. I'm happy anytime God does it, but I myself know he doesn't do it all the time. My wife and I have experienced a series of miscarriages that have been painful, and we know, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but that doesn't do away with the reality of when it does happen. miracles aren't meant to be a quick fix for the world's problems. We need to work on those ourselves. But they're signs of the kingdom. They're a foretaste of a better future, when there's going to be no more sickness. There's going to be no more death. There's going to be no more tears. They're a foretaste of what God has for us. But God doesn't bring in the kingdom in its fullness now, because when God brings it in, there's going to be perfect righteousness, perfect justice, no more oppression, no more sin. And some of the people who are saying, yeah, well, where is he now? I'm not sure that they would really want him to bring in perfect justice and righteousness, because they're going to be in trouble. According to, you know, the biblical perspective on, we need to be ready for his kingdom. And God has been gracious not to send it all right now. So in the meantime, we need to keep working, both physically, medical work, healthcare, justice, and preaching the good news that transforms people's lives as we're getting ready for the fullness of the kingdom.
You use the word sign or yeah. signs, and I think that's really good. I know John uses it a lot in his gospel, but the idea of being a miracle points us yes. to the Lord who saves us. And in John, it's always tied to the teaching of Christ. And that's the idea, isn't it, that there should be instruction. And it's not about pointing to me.
Yes.
The idea that God should be doing us 24/7 with every prayer, would, if I had that ability, if he gave that to me, everyone would be looking at me. But if I have to humble myself and it's all in God's hands and he moves at his own wish and desire, it always points to him. And that's what the Bible teaches, isn't it?
Yeah, and if it happened all the time, then somebody like Hume would come along and say, that's just natural law.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't be considered a miracle and draw people's attention to it. I think that something deeper in Christian understanding, biblical understanding, there's something that goes deeper than the miracles. The miracles are signs of the future, but the deepest revelation to us is the cross. Because when we see that in the midst of complete brokenness, in a travesty of justice, in the greatest, most intense, unjust suffering that has ever been experienced, that somebody completely righteous who suffered on behalf of the rest of the world, in the midst of that, God was still working out his purposes. Then we can have faith to believe that in the midst of tragedy, in the times when God doesn't answer our prayers right away or the way we want him to, we can still trust that God still loves us, God still has a purpose, and there's going to come a time when it's going to be all right.
Beautiful, beautiful. So one last question I have as we're running down on our time now. As you talk about the cross, the idea of the atonement, some people love to quote, by his stripes we're healed. As a theologian, do you have any insight for us on that whole topic of healing in the atonement?
Sure. In Isaiah, where it says, by his stripes we're healed, the context of the healing there, and often in the biblical prophets, they were speaking of spiritual healing, healing from sin. But it also has a broader connection in Isaiah, which first century readers would have read as a whole. The broader connection is a restoration, a complete restoration, not only from sin, but from its effects. Isaiah 35 talks about the restoration of creation, the deserts blossoming with lilies and so on, and goes on to talk about the disabled leaping for joy, the deaf ears being opened, and so on. And Jesus quotes from Isaiah 35 that his ministry was, in a sense, a foretaste of that ultimate restoration. So in 1 Peter, you have this passage about by his stripes we're healed. You have that context quoted with reference to sin. But in Matthew chapter 8, you have it quoted with reference to healing of the body as well. And I think the point is that, even though healing doesn't always come now, it's a foretaste of what Jesus really has purchased for us. He's purchased for us, yes, salvation, but a whole new world, a whole restoration of body and the environment and everything. I think the point is that when we experience gifts from God's grace, we need to remember that it cost Him something to give us those things. We had rebelled against Him. We had gone our own way. But because of God's great love for us, He offered us, He's provided for us restoration.
Thank you, Craig. Listeners, if you'd like to follow up and read articles of Dr. Keener or books, his last name is spelled K-E-E-N-E-R, Craig Keener. Go to Amazon, Google his name, you'll find books there. Go to Asbury Seminary site, you'll find excellent articles. Dr. Keener, how would you refer people if they're looking for more?
The Miracles book has, of course, it cites a lot of sources, and there are just a lot of sources out there.
I meant looking for your stuff.
Oh, looking for my stuff?
Yeah.
Christian book distributors, you can go online for Christianbook.com or Christianbooks.com, I forget, but Christian book distributors also carries them.
And I recommend Dr. Keener's blog. Just Google Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R, and you'll find a lot there. Dr. Keener, thank you so much. We appreciate the ministry you have in writing and in teaching, and you've inspired us today.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, join us next week as we have Dr. Tony Evans on talking about hope for the city.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.